thinking about the work of Sean Daniels lately. If you don't know Sean, he's a former artistic director of several theaters, a director, a playwright, and a person who has experience around addiction and recovery. He currently works as the director of the Recovery Project at Florida Studio Theater. The Recovery Project is working to change the narrative around the public health crisis of addiction in the United States. I've never met Sean, but I've been following him in the social media sense for many years. So, when he made the move from running a highly respected regional theater in Arizona to running the Recovery Project in Florida, I was at first taken aback, but quickly became inspired as I saw the work he was doing. I'm not a person with direct experience with addiction or recovery, but the consumption of alcohol has been at the front of my mind since I was a teenager. I had a biological father who was an alcoholic, and I drank twice when I was 15, and I decided at that point I had to stop because I was afraid of becoming him. And I held true to that choice through the remainder of high school, which was not easy as I had some friends experimenting with a litany of substances, and the football team parties after games were typically beer-soaked. In college, I was the non-drinker in a typically heavy drinking college environment. I found it incredibly alienating because of how the consumption of alcohol was the centerpiece of any event. Looking back, I think the person I evolved to be as an adult was formed by my choice to isolate myself to avoid most parties in this time period. When I left college and headed out into life, dating was weird. "Oh, you don't drink? Should I not drink? I won't drink, should I?" was the typical start to a date. I never felt comfortable at work events or parties through my 20s, all because of this. I developed a great deal of social anxiety. However, the older I got, the less pressure I felt. People generally didn't care that much, but I always felt out of place, so I tended to stand near the door and mastered the Irish exit. Later, when I became involved in theater, I saw how drinking was a centerpiece of that culture. Opening night parties, see a show, grab a drink, have a chat. As I approached 40, I learned my father passed away, and I felt myself going through a little bit of a life change. I started to wonder if I could drink socially like a normal person. I'm putting humongous quote marks around the word normal. I thought about it for several years. I just wanted to be part of the conversations I felt like I was missing. I wanted to be able to ask somebody if they wanted to grab a beer. I grew up watching Cheers. I thought bar life was supposed to be a part of adulthood. Around this time period, I met with my uncle, who himself was in recovery. I told him where my mind was on the subject, and he said, "You've got the gene, so don't do it." "Do I? Is it genetic?" I didn't know. I still have no idea. But I decided to dabble anyway. Today we have a small bar cart at home. I drink from time to time, I ask people out for drinks, and I feel okay about it, but the feelings of isolation and social awkwardness that developed when I was younger are still there. Now that I'm on this side of the conversation, what I thought was the normal place to be, I see how batshit it is that I consider drinking the normal way to behave and sobriety abnormal. And I think that's because I always felt outside of people. This journey has not made me feel any better about the cultural placement of booze at its center. I don't think I have the gene, if there is one, but I never stop thinking about it. And that's one reason why I have so much admiration for the work Sean Daniels is doing. He wrote a play called The White Chip about his experiences as an alcoholic, which just had a critically acclaimed run off Broadway. That play, along with the Recovery Project, and his mere existence as a positive voice in our culture, is destigmatizing addiction and sobriety in beautiful ways. And I just wanted to take this opportunity to shout him out, bring his work to your attention, and, I don't know, maybe contribute to changing the clumsy and dangerous ways many of us portray drugs and alcohol in our work, and in our lives use it less as a unifying force for gathering people together. And for myself, I guess, change the way I frame what is normal versus what is not. Welcome to the Subtext Podcast. My name is Brian James Polak. This month on the Subtext, I share a conversation with Jenny Lamb. Before we get to that, just a little reminder, we're out here on the socials if you want to connect, and I'm always open to hearing directly from you. If there's something you'd like to say, you can send an email to thesubtextpodcast@gmail.com, or you could give us a call or text even at 505-302-1235. And people don't do this much these days, but if you are so motivated, you can rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts. But really, if you want to do anything and can only do one thing, please share this podcast with the folks in your life who you think might be interested in hearing from some great playwrights working today. Onward. Jenny Lamb is a Chicago-based playwright and producer. Her plays include Motherlode, Quiver, Candy Store, Memento Polonia, Period Piece, Thou Proud Dream, Jumble of Bones, and Waterway. Jenny has worked across the country with Pivot Arts, The Road Theater, The Goodman Theater, The Gift, Stage Left Theater, Project Y, Lynx Hall, Flint Rep, Broken Nose, Wordsmith Theater, Northwestern University, and Chicago Dramatists. She is the founder of Second Sight, a writing collective focused on creating new work in non-traditional spaces. Jenny holds an MFA in writing for the screen and stage from Northwestern University. This conversation was recorded at Jenny's beautiful house in Chicago in March of 2024.
Like in thinking about this and listening to all the people on your podcast, I'm like, nobody knows who I am. And I'm at such an interesting point in my playwriting journey, I think like a couple years ago, just because I'm like expanding into so many different types of writing that I wasn't before. And I feel like I've really like, last year, I really flipped the table on some stuff.
Yeah.
That when I did it, I was like, this is going to end things for me. Well, like next year, I left a commission.
Yeah.
I left my agent and I left my teaching job. And, you know, I'm lucky enough that my family is in a place where I can do that for a little while. But it was the best thing I could have done. I'm so much happier. I feel like in this moment, March 1st, 2024, I feel pretty like creatively fulfilled. And, you know, I mean, we both know that doesn't last. But that's how I feel like. I picked the thing, you know, this is the thing. This is the thing I'm going to probably write out the rest of my career on.
These are reasons why I love that we're having this conversation right now. Mm-hmm. It would have been awesome to even do it like 3-4 years ago, maybe 5 years ago, like 4 or 5 years ago when we met and we're like spending some time together writing. That conversation would be very different because this time period, so much has changed.
Yeah.
And I love that it's happening now, right? It happens whenever it happens, and it's happening now because of all of these things you referred to, which a lot of them we'll probably get to.
Yeah.
But let's track back. Let's go back.
Okay.
And get to this sort of life shift that you're in at the moment.
Yeah.
We'll tee that up a little bit.
Okay.
Something I love to know, and this is something I don't know about you, is like, what was your entry point into being a creative person when you were younger? Because I don't even know, some people, like for me, I was an adult when I came to it, and some people, they're 4 years old, and I'm curious where you were when that landed.
I was not 4 years old when I came to writing. I was in high school, and in the 10th grade, I went to a Catholic school, and Mr. Klein was my teacher. And I took a creative writing class and I met one of my best friends there, and it just was like, and I had like been a journaler right? Like, I love journaling. I loved writing in my diary and hiding it away and having this secret thing that nobody could see. Although years later, lots of people read my diary, which made me very angry. But it was this creative writing class that I took in high school that really was like, it just, like, my body felt it. And I had been in theater. Like, I hated school. I was kind of an awkward kid. And once I got involved with plays and theater, I found my people and I liked school, and it just was exactly the outlet I needed. And I think writing was like, you know, the icing on the cake. It was like, you know, this, like, you know, like being that, and maybe you feel this way. Mm. It's like this kind of, cause I spent years as like a performer.
Mm-hmm.
And it always felt like, you know, I'm just a little bit too shy for this. It's like a little bit, you know, I love other people, and that's why I'm not a novelist, because I don't think I could do that kind of solitary work that's needed to do that. So
performing came first for you?
Performing came first.
What was it, looking back, can you identify what it was about you that, like, I don't know, made that work?
I like attention.
Yeah.
I do like attention. I hate to say it. I was like, and that, like, performing came first. So I was in Polish dance when I was really young, probably like 6 years old. And I did dance through middle school. Mm-hmm. And then I decided I was too cool for it. And then, you know, in high school, some friends were in the school play, and I didn't have anything else to do. I wasn't good at sports.
Yeah.
And I just really, like, because, like, growing up, my dad has a really big family, and I grew up with, like, 10 cousins. We were all a year ahead, you know, apart from each other.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just this kind of big, unruly gang. And, you know, sort of rowdy, and I like that environment. I like being with people who are creating something together. So I think that's what drew me to.
Did you struggle for attention at home? Do you have siblings?
I have a brother. I have a brother. Did I struggle for attention? I mean, I grew up downriver outside of Detroit. That's what the area is called. This is just sort of blue collar group of suburbs south of the city that a lot of auto workers live in. My parents are both super hardworking. My dad worked nights at the River Rouge, the Rouge factory in Detroit, in Dearborn, I guess. And my mom was a secretary and was also going to school. So we stayed with my grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
My grandparents were Polish immigrants. We did not speak each other's languages. And I sadly never learned Polish, which I, as an adult, I really regret that. So there was a lot of, like, communication was always really difficult. We had to sort of come up with ways to communicate past the language, with gestures, with these sort of hybrid words that we would come up with, to stand for things. And I think that definitely informs my writing.
Yeah.
That I see when I write scripts, the language is a barrier. It's not necessarily how these characters are bearing their soul. It's like the mud that they have to walk through to make a connection on the other side.
That's interesting. My grandparents on my mom's side, they were born in the U.S., but their parents were French.
Mm.
They came down from Quebec to work in the mills in New England, which was very common at the time. And like, these mills were populated with French immigrants from Canada. And so my grandparents grew up in bilingual, and they would always shift to French when they wanted to hide what they were saying from me and my sister. And it made me want to learn French. And then I started to learn French, and I was like, this is too hard.
Yes. My mom and my grandmother used to speak Polish. And I would just listen really close to their tone to try to figure out what they were saying to each other. And there were words I can, you know, I could pick up. But like that tone too is so key and so exciting when you're writing dialogue to play with that.
For sure. Yeah. For sure. I was wearing, so I know very little Polish too. And we've talked about our shared Polishness. So I have this winter hat from Poland and I was wearing it the other day. I went to this coffee shop and the person working the coffee shop started talking Polish to me because my hat said Polska.
Oh, yeah.
And it was very Polish and not from a hat from the U.S. It was definitely from from over there. And I was like, nope.
Please stop.
And I said, I know, dziękuję, dzień dobry. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Yeah.
So good morning, good day, and thank you.
Yeah.
So that's what you're going to get out of me.
Right.
And he was like, oh, sorry. He was like, I just get excited because I don't meet a lot of Polish people. And I was like, I am Polish, but you wouldn't know it if you talked to me.
Right.
So did you grow up in a household that was really sort of like conducive to being creative, or was it just like Jenny can go do whatever she wants to do at school?
Yeah, I mean, not really. It was it turned out to be conducive to being creative, but you know, my parents were very like have a very very strong work ethic. They're very Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that I think was most conducive to my creativity. Like, first of all, I think it's just, you know, it's like if you are someone who's going to go into theater or the arts, that's just who you are. And I believe you'll find a way no matter what. Mm. The thing that was the most conducive to creativity, I think, first of all, was probably the time I spent with my grandparents because I had to work so hard to get my needs, you know, to get my needs met and to communicate.
Right.
But also, like a lot of people in Detroit, my family had a second house in Northern Michigan because at the time, and I think this is still the case, auto workers made really decent money. And so we were able to afford a place in this town called Tawas, Michigan. And there was no TV up there, which I hated growing up. Hated it. Couldn't, you know, radio. Like, I couldn't see my friends. But it's this beautiful lake. And, you know, we just spent our time reading and running around. And this giant, like, sort of like lawn path that goes to the lake. And it's just, to me, like, when I think of creating something, I think of that, like, blank slate. This just, like, woodsy setting of, like, what could possibly happen there. So I think that is really where the creativity came and having that, like, you know, just like go out and play and turn the TV off, like that was really what helped me have space for that kind of thing.
Do you have a sense of looking back what you imagined life to be or your future to be or what you wanted to do when you became an adult?
I think that when I was, you know, it was always like in this kind of like teacher ballerina for a little while. I wanted to be a veterinarian because I love animals. But then when I figured out that you had to actually like, you know, do surgery and stuff, it was like, no, I can't do that. And I think coming out of high school, if I hadn't come from the kind of family that was very, very practical, just like you need to get a job that pays money, I think I would have gone into TV like right away.
To be an actor?
To be like a producer.
Yeah.
So, yes. And so this is, I don't know that this matters, but when I was in high school and in drama, like the local PBS I don't remember what it is in Detroit, but they had this game show that they were trying out for teenagers. Mm-hmm. And so they wanted volunteers. And of course I was like, yes, I'll do it. That I ended up meeting this woman, and I remember her name. Her name was Kat, and she was a producer, and she had really cool glasses, and it was like the 80s. And I was like, that is the person I want to be. I want to be her.
Wow.
But then when college came up, I got scared because, you know, in Detroit, I didn't know anybody else who mm-hmm. That was just like crazy talk. And, you know, I'd had so many teachers that I loved, and it was like, you know, I love performing, I love writing, I'll be an English teacher. Hmm. And so that's what I went to school for, and that's what I did for the first 5 years after I got my degree.
Mm-hmm. Detroit has this sort of, like, mythic quality to it, mm-hmm. particularly for those of us like me who... I've been a couple times for like work things, but I don't know the city. Having come from that area, do you have a sense of its evolution, or was it already evolving out of its heyday when you were, do you remember this when you were growing up?
Yeah, it wasn't. It wasn't, but it was just this kind of magical place. Mm-hmm. For me, you know, for me, like, it was always kind of by my family was painted to be dangerous, but my mom worked in Detroit, and my experience of it was mostly with like underground dance clubs.
So it
was this like very exciting, fun place that, you know, we weren't really allowed to go, mm-hmm. but we would do it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, getting fake IDs, which would never really work. But I think now it is changing and it is shifting and it is sort of like coming into its own, in a way, like more vitality than it's had.
Before I became a playwright, around the time I was starting to write, I took this short story writing class. Mm. And the teacher was from Detroit.
Mm.
And the story that I wrote was about Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
And it talked about, it really was mining my own experiences of Detroit through television.
Mm-hmm.
like sports riots really was what defined Detroit for me growing up. Was like the Detroit Pistons would win the championship,
mm-hmm.
and then everybody would hit the streets and there'd be cars smashed and like that kind of stuff. That isn't Detroit,
right?
But that was Detroit through the eyes of like young me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was writing this, I wrote this short story and through this lens. And my teacher got so offended because he was mad that this is how Detroit was being defined.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh wow, like I really touched a nerve. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't written to be like slamming the city of Detroit mm-hmm. at all.
Mm-hmm.
And he was so offended by it. And I was like very much in the mode of, I want to please my teacher. I want my teacher to love my writing.
Yeah.
And I want to be a good writer. And I lost him because of this. And then years later, I told this story and I was like, wait, I'm kind of mad.
Mm.
I'm kind of mad that I wasn't given the license to explore this narrative.
Right.
Because it was a narrative through the lens of a person who saw a city in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean the place was that certain way.
Right.
And I kind of want to find that teacher.
It doesn't surprise me because I think that, I mean, you know, you probably find this too, like living in different cities, like what the kind of language, like, you know, like the language, like the not just a regional dialect, which I have to say for years, I'm trying to nail down the Detroit mm-hmm. white working class, because it's there is something. I mean, like Minnesota, Wisconsin, but like Detroit, there's a thing.
Yeah.
And I can't quite nail it down, probably because I talk that way. But it doesn't surprise me that he got angry, because that, like, I grew up in like a very, like, I don't know, like, people were mad. They were just mad. Like, you know, like mad at the lack of economic opportunity.
Yeah.
Mad at the way that Detroit's always looked down on.
Yeah.
You know, maybe this sort of like factory culture that bled out to, you know, the kids that I grew up with.
Yeah. Yeah. I get it.
It's like a chip on their shoulder.
I get it.
Yeah.
I got it. I understand that perspective, that human perspective. Where it bothers me is when it shifted into the teacher how to write.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. I was like, you're still a teacher teaching me how to write. So let's focus on the writing component. And he was so offended by my really, really inoffensive talking about the Pistons winning the championship. Right. So you graduate from college and you become an English teacher.
Mm-hmm.
But you mentioned around 10th grade, you had Mr. Klein kind of like nudging you to write.
Mm-hmm.
So how did, like, was that simply a seed that got planted and it took a few years to grow? Or were you writing outside of the journal? Were you writing?
I was writing. And, you know, I think my dad always wanted me to be a writer because, and I still have it downstairs. When I was in, when I was a senior in high school, he bought me this book that was like, how to submit your piece to get published. And it was like, you know, back in the day when there was an internet and it was all these like publishers and publishers' names where you could submit manuscripts. So I hung on to that, but I still like felt like I needed to have a job to support myself. And I really found teaching to be not, I still teach to this day.
Yeah.
I'll just say that the schedule of a high school teacher, like, that's not me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so glad, grateful that there are wonderful people who love to do it, who are good at it, who are efficient.
Mm-hmm.
I am like the opposite of efficient. It just wasn't
so you went straight from undergrad into a high school?
Oh yeah. Wow. I was 21 when I started teaching. I was 2 years older than my oldest student. It was the hardest year of my life.
Mm-hmm.
They hired me like 2 years into, no, 2 years, like a month into the school year, because the teacher who had my job before retired in like July. So they had to do the search, and the woman who was teaching before didn't tell the kids that she was a substitute. And so I started 2 weeks into the year.
So they had a teacher from day one and didn't know that that wasn't going to be their teacher.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And so I got hired as a 21-year-old to teach three different classes of English, right? Like six periods, but like three different classes, one being senior English.
Mm-hmm.
I was the drama coach. I was the assistant speech coach. And I did something called contest play.
What's that?
It's like you take a play that your school did and you pare it down to like an hour, and there's like a million rules, which I didn't read any of them because I had no time.
Right.
I mean, no time. I've never worked so hard in my life. Yeah, it was a rough year.
But you made it five.
I made it five, and then I left to be an improviser.
Okay.
Because it was the 90s, and I was like, goodbye! I mean, I'm a table flipper. Like, I will just be like, I'm done. Boof.
Yeah.
On to the next thing.
Was it like, so was there a point during that 5-year period where you're like, I need to GTFO, or were you just going along and suddenly it came to you, you need to leave?
I think I was always like, oh, there's got to be something else.
It was always temporary.
I'm not ready. I'm not ready. And that the thing that I didn't anticipate, which is, you know, you feel like you're back in high school. So it's like, I went through high school, I went to college, and now I'm back in high school? Mm-hmm. And I have to do the schedule and the bells and the lunch that's like 20 minutes long.
Right.
And like, that's not, like, there's no variance. There's no variance in the schedule. Like, I just couldn't, it was just crushing me as a young person. Like, when I look at pictures of myself from then,
mm-hmm.
I look older than I do now. Just my expression, because I'm so...
You were so worn.
Exhausted.
Yeah.
And it, you know, like I said, like, I don't have the, like, aptitude, capacity, just general like organizational skills. It's not easy for me, you know. It's hard, and I think for some people that's just naturally how they move through life.
Do you know anybody you taught with still today? Are they?
I keep in touch with them on Facebook.
Are they still teaching?
They're still teaching. Yeah.
Isn't that so? I just remember growing up that all of my teachers were lifers.
Mm-hmm.
They all came out of college or grad school or whatever, started mm-hmm. teaching, and then they taught until retirement.
Yeah.
And that was like the norm. But I think that kind of was the norm generationally. Like, people got into a job and
mm-hmm.
and stayed with that job.
Yeah. Yeah.
Until the end.
And they have like the, and that's the other thing. I just felt like too much structure. Like, I couldn't handle like how structured it was. It felt the opposite of safe to me. It felt like I was just being imprisoned in this system. I think, like, you know, during those 4 years, you know, in my early 20s, that's what I that's how I spent it. I would always think, like, so what do you really want to do? You know, like, these are the conversations that I wanted to have with my fellow teachers. They're like, well, I want to teach.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, yeah. Yeah.
You're like, me too, me too.
Me too, me too. Yeah, yeah. Forget I said. What did I just say? Forget that.
Yeah. Somebody else was talking about this.
Yeah, exactly, exactly, exactly. Yeah.
But, like, you left to be an improviser, but that's not a, like, that's not a job where you make money.
It's not.
I mean,
well,
it kind of is for some folks.
Right, right, right.
But
yeah. So I, it was 1997, I took an improv class because really I just needed to make friends.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't.
That's
know
why
anybody.
I did it too.
Yeah. And I did, like, I still have friends.
Same here.
Some of my best friends are from that time in my life. So I took a class with this company called the Free Associates.
Where were you, like, geographically?
Oh, Chicago.
Okay.
Yeah. Lincoln. So first I did the conservatory at Second City,
mm-hmm.
which it was Players Workshop at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked that, but I think sketch, like, it wasn't exactly my thing. And then I took a class with the Free Associates, and they did shows at the Ivanhoe. Do you remember the Ivanhoe?
Mm-mm.
So the Ivanhoe is where Binney's is on, Wellington and Halsted.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And so I took this class, and they did long form parodies, and their advertisement was, it was something like, do you want to be a spoofster? And I was like, yes, I want to be a spoofster. And they did improvise Shakespeare. They did improvise Mammoth. They did improvise Tennessee Williams. They did improvise the show ER.
Uh-huh.
Dark Shadows, if you remember that show.
I do, yeah.
So I took this class, and part of the class, they were like, okay, we're going to do this show BS, which was ER.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just going to be like a 4-week thing. like just for students.
Mm-hmm.
That show ran for 2 years. And so for a year, I was teaching and performing. So in the going into the fifth year, I stopped doing the drama stuff because I had my own stuff.
Yeah.
And I was young. You know, I was like, this is it. I'm going to do this. So I was part of that group for a couple years, and they made me a company member, and then that's when I left teaching and just took like a temp job, because at that time in history,
mm-hmm.
in the 90s, there were so many jobs, and I made not much less than I made as a teacher and had way more free time.
Yeah. I mean, we're kind of close in age, and I remember this, I actually don't know how old you are, but I like just like
I'll never tell.
You don't need to tell, but what I mean is like I understand your cultural references and timeline.
Yeah, good.
Like
good.
Because I was existing in the same timeline, and I remember coming out of college in the 90s and like jobs being a choice. Which one am I going to take?
Mm-hmm.
Right? I'm going to go to these interviews and then I get to decide which job I'm going to take.
Yeah.
And then I remember taking a job and then like leaving and not worrying that I'm mm-hmm. like health insurance, I'll get the next job. And like jobs just existed.
Yeah.
I had a job for a few years that started making me miserable and I just quit,
mm-hmm.
Gave my notice. They're like, where are you going? And I'm like, I don't know.
Another job.
Right. And then a month later I had another job
with
health insurance and all that stuff. And it was just like, it's definitely a sort of level of privilege
mm-hmm.
for our mm-hmm. Gen Xers that we had.
Yes.
We didn't experience the same kind of professional anxieties that folks coming up behind us have coming out of college. So what I mean is like I can totally understand where you're coming from in this area.
Yeah.
You can get the temp job.
Right.
I just had like office jobs that I didn't really care about while I was starting to do like improv and stuff on the side
mm-hmm.
and coming to a point where I learned I just cared more about my outside of job life
mm-hmm.
Than I did. But yet, and still, I'm sure you bump into this today, like when we meet people and we identify, like, what do you do is like the question, right? And I was like a paralegal.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I'm not a paralegal, but I do that to make money to pay bills so I can do this stuff on the side.
Right.
But that's what, when you meet a new person, that's what they want to hear is, what do you do for a job? Because that's how so many people identify.
Yes.
And I'm like, oh, I don't identify. And today, like, I make money as a grant writer,
mm-hmm.
but when I meet people, I'm a playwright.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then you have to talk about the economics of play. Like, it just opens up this whole
thing. So what does that mean?
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I can't even imagine back when I was doing improv, or so I'm curious if this is how you did it, meeting somebody, what do you do? Oh, I'm an improviser.
Yeah.
Right? Like scramble the brain a little bit in that conversation.
Yes.
Like were you, when you started to do temp work while you were doing this acting and performing, were you starting to identify yourself in that way? Like, this is the trajectory I want to go on.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I spent a long time wanting to be a comedian, you know, like that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to get famous and
like Saturday Night Live sketch comedy stuff.
Yeah. I was in the first, you know, Chicago Improv Festival, which honestly, I imagine it's still a thing, right? I hope it's still a thing, but when I was doing improv, I was in the first one. And so my company got like those like JV jackets to wear. And so there were all these like groups at this at this festival, and we were super proud, and there were scouts there. And there were scouts for the Aspen Comedy Festival, mm-hmm. and so like they were interested in us. They were interested in us. And they were interested in the Upright Citizens Brigade.
Mm-hmm.
And so Amy Poehler was there, and she went on to obviously become famous. They didn't pick our group, they picked her, but I was very much wanting that to happen. Mm-hmm. And I did comedy for a long time and just came to a point in my life where I was like, this isn't completely doing it for me anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I love this because I have realized recently that every decade of my life I've completely shifted.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like the you could say I blew up my life and started over again, mm-hmm. or you could say shift. I like to be dramatic.
Yeah.
So I exploded my life in my 20s, mm-hmm. and I exploded it again in my 30s, and again in my 40s, and I actually don't have any regrets with that. And this sort of connects with what I was saying before, what we were talking about before, about getting into a profession and staying with it up until retirement, mm-hmm. like the generation mm-hmm. before us right. did. And I came to a point, and it wasn't very long ago, really, like after blowing up my life multiple times, being completely comfortable in it.
Yeah.
And maybe I'll do it 4 more times.
Yeah.
I don't care.
Yeah.
This is what life
it's
is.
Your life. Yeah.
This is what this life is, and yeah. it's totally fine.
Right. 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 Yeah. Why toil away in something you hate?
Right. And this is sort of what we're getting to with your narrative. Like, you had these shifts mm-hmm. regularly through mm-hmm. your adult life. And I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it is that sort of like, you know, there comes a point where it's just not worth it anymore. And you kind of see the writing on the wall. And I sort of had this shift. I had this shift in comedy, which was a little softer because I really have such fond memories. And like I said, a lot of my friends are still, mm-hmm. Some of them are still doing comedy. A lot of them have moved on to just, you know, straight up acting. But I just saw, like, you know, I you know, the life of doing bits and bits and bits,
mm-hmm.
you know, that comedy becomes, which is very fun. I just found that, like, creatively, I wanted something deeper that comedy wasn't necessarily giving me anymore.
Yeah.
And so about, gosh, how long was it? It was like about 16 years ago now. I wrote, produced, and acted in my own play. And that shifted it for me. And that was like, I want to be a playwright now.
Was it a solo play?
It wasn't. No, it was. It was called Memento Polonia.
Mm-hmm.
It's about my grandmother. Mm. I did it at the Peter Jones Gallery, which I don't think is there anymore. It was this huge, sprawling loft space. You know, it was for art openings, but they had a little theater, and I got it for $50 a night. $50 a night. It was like a 50 seat house. And so I think I lost track of what I was talking about.
Was this
about
a serious play?
Yeah.
Was it a drama?
I mean, there was it was funny, but also it had some seriousness to it. Mm-hmm. So it was about like a mother, son, immigrant, older woman, and her son, her adult son, and sort of her reflecting back on her life in Poland. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, my grandparents were there for Nazi and Soviet occupation,
mm-hmm.
and just kind of what that was. It was like a collage play, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
It was very much, you know, it was very informed by, because the work I did as a comedian was mostly long form.
Yeah.
And so just be like, I have a character, give some suggestions, here's an hour long play. And so we would just, you know, make it in front of their eyes and mm-hmm. it looked like magic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that play like very much came out of that muscle that I was always exercising of just like, you know, maybe the plot isn't necessarily there.
Right.
It's more of like a memory piece, kind of patched together, nonlinear.
Yeah. So in this time period, when you're in the thick of performing, mm-hmm. especially comedy, especially in the sort of like sketch comedy, improv world, the the dream is, right, Saturday Night Live. Mm-hmm. It's to be those folks and what that leads to, mm-hmm. like that kind of stardom. When you shift out of that, mm-hmm. right, that's no longer the dream. Like, mm-hmm. what did you imagine your life being at that point?
I think, again, I was pointing towards TV.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just like putting this together for myself, because shortly after the play, I had a baby, like mm-hmm. 2 years later, and then it was 2008, so the economy just grind to a halt,
mm-hmm.
and I was working in publishing at the time for my day job, and publishing was such a great job in the early 2000s because it paid really well. It was very flexible. And then, you know, it went from being like $25, $30 an hour to 50 cents a page.
Mm.
And so, and then the work dried up because it was going offshore. And so it was like, this, something has to shift. That shift was very much sort of dictated. I mean, maybe
forced,
I would have
forced on you a little
kind
bit,
of,
right?
Yeah. So that's when I went to Northwestern for grad school, with the thought in mind that, like, okay, I'm gonna go in because I want to teach, I want to work on commissions, and I want to get an agent.
Mm-hmm.
And I met all those goals, and then last year I was like, time to move on from this.
Yeah, I mean, so you don't have to go into like painstaking detail if you don't want to,
yeah, yeah.
But like, we don't need to sort of like map out chronologically every single thing that happened from
yeah.
grad school to the present, but you set out some goals for yourself and you achieved those goals, and some of them, speaking as a person who works in the same field as a playwright, mm-hmm. Aren't easy. Right, they aren't choices. Mm-hmm. They are like achievements, mm-hmm. right? Getting an agent, getting commissions, all this stuff you have to work for mm-hmm. and earn them, and you did, right? So, when these things were happening for you in this time period, were you ever feeling like, I'm doing it?
Oh yeah.
I'm doing the thing. This is great.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yes. I did feel like things were really clicking, and I got really, you know, I mean, you know, I'm not going to go into the gory details, but like got so painfully close to professional productions and they kept falling apart. And then with commissions, I just felt like the last 5 years and you know, some of that's just pandemic. Mm-hmm. Like things really changed for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
It just felt like I am stuck in development hell and it's kind of making me miserable.
Mm-hmm.
So something has to shift. But yes, I did feel many times that like, this is it. This is what I want.
Yeah.
Things are going where I want it to. And of course, like, you lose perspective too sometimes, right? It's like you're doing the thing that you always wanted to do.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, I have to go do that thing, you
yeah.
know? Because it just becomes rote, I guess, or you forget about the magic of it, or you forget how lucky you are to be able to have the privilege to do, you know, work on these projects. Or sometimes it's like the pressure or the expectations of who you're working with can sometimes kill the joy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, talk to me about that next shift. So you spent years, mm-hmm. right, where you were getting these commissions, you were writing these plays, you got an agent, things were getting tantalizingly close, mm-hmm. and then not happening, and like, was there a straw that broke the back? Like, what was the next transition for you?
The straw there were a couple things that happened simultaneously last year that led to like a big shift for me.
Mm-hmm.
I was working on a commission. And it just kept not going anywhere. Kept not going anywhere. Kept not going anywhere.
Meaning you wrote the play, you were working with the theater.
Yeah, it was just like... And it wasn't like advancing. Yeah. I can't say too much about this contractually, but...
can we speak about it in general terms?
Yeah. I worked on an idea, which I do a lot. People come to me with their ideas, and they're like, let's work on this
together. Yeah.
Because I like collaborative work.
Mm-hmm.
But this was different in that I'd never met this person before. I mean, usually when you do that with friends, it's different. Like, you can be like, you know, get to a point and then you're like, let's put it down. And,
My life has changed.
Yeah, let's put it down and work on it later. But this was for a producer who I'd never met before.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, our collaboration just couldn't, it just never...
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm doing this motion that you can't see on the microphone. It never stuck. We couldn't get on the same page.
Creatively.
And it just came to a point where I was miserable because I kept turning out work that was not moving forward. It was like, go back. And I think the well ran dry. At the time, I asked my agent to... I think it's time to get out of this. This is not going anywhere because it really was a point where I had to put my mental, emotional health ahead of work.
Mm-hmm.
So that wrapped up. At the same time, my friend Chris Murphy, who works at District Furniture Store, who also was my high school student, He and I had collaborated on a site-based piece, or we used his furniture store for a performance in 2014, I believe, with Living Room Playmakers. And he loved it, and I loved it, and he's like, let's do this again. And I'm like, oh, Chris, like, I sure, but I don't have any money. Like, how are we going to pay for this? And so I... thought about it, and I was like, well, I'll try 3 Arts because I just gotten a Make-A-Wave grant or Make-A-Wave award. I forget how they phrase it exactly. And so I met with 3 Arts, and they were like, you should do this crowdfunding campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did it, and we raised the money, and then it was I hired 11 writers. And I think we used like 20 some actors to put this big piece together. And that really was like, this is where I need to go now.
When you started this, were you like, oh, I just have an idea for a project, and it was just another project to work on?
It was something, this is something that I wanted to do, since before the pandemic. I wanted to start a site-based company, much like the Living Room Playmakers that I worked with, but everyone had moved on. So in like 2019, I started talking about how I wanted to start Second Sight. And then the pandemic happened. And of course it was like, well, that's, you know, that's a dead idea. That's not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
And so the work that we did last fall really propelled this collective forward. And now that's what I do. Like, pretty much every day is work on getting work for that collective and figuring out how our hierarchy is going to be and just trying to think about what a how this would be how we can make this viable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What was it about that project that that worked for you, right? Because you were in this period where things just creatively, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it just seems like creatively things weren't working for you.
Yeah,
things needed to change. What was it about this project that was different? And can you give a little context about, like, what it was?
Yeah, so the show that we created was called Wants and Needs, and it was a site-based show that took place in two stores next to each other, one being a furniture store, one being a sort of like boutique called Panapaz in Ravenswood in Chicago. And that piece was four live performances and 11, I think it's 11 audio pieces. And so it was, I just found it so joyful. I think after pandemic, I think a lot of us were just hungry for connection. And being able to be in a community like that. And also like after having so many experiences where I was so close to being produced and not produced, it was just my absolute, absolute pleasure to support and, you know, just to support and produce 11 really talented writers and give them a show at the same time. That and not in a way that's like and be able to pay them fairly because of the three arts grant. And to really like feature them, like make it like a writer forward piece. What do I mean by that? I'm going to have to think about that for a second because I feel like I'm talking ahead of myself.
Yeah, well, it's all good. I did have a 25 second pause at the beginning of this where I didn't know what we're going to talk about. So this is how our brains work.
Yeah, it's okay. It's okay. I think that also my experience in Chicago as a writer, because I've been a part of a lot of communities of writers, you know, and I count like the companies of improvisers that I've been a part of as a community of writers. But I feel like we're in like a weird time where it's really, and other people might be like, what are you talking about? There's tons of community in right for writers. A lot of the writers I talk to who are based in Chicago right now are not feeling connected to the work. And you know, again, it's pandemic. A lot has shifted. But I think like when I look at other cities, even like Minneapolis or New York, like they have more infrastructure to support writers maybe. And so that is also very important to me. And because like the great thing about Chicago is that we're an ensemble town, and those ensembles are actors, which is also amazing. And I don't say any of this to slam anybody, but it does put writers in this town in a really weird position because you're having to like create work. The writers are not running the show. Not that they should, but like that's why I think like maybe a lot of work from out of town gets done here. And we just need that support. We need, you know, I reach a point as a writer where it's like, if I'm not going to get a production, I can't do anymore. Like I need, like there needs to be like actors get walk-on roles or like a small part. There needs to be that for writers, you know, where we're like giving, and you know, and that's not to say I haven't been given chances. I have. But there's just some like missing piece that maybe I'm not connecting to. And I just like, I love writers. I want to nurture writers. I want to cook for them. I want to like help them and cheerlead them and give them work. Yeah.
So somewhere in the beginning of our conversation, you talked about how you've come to this moment and this is what you want to be doing now, right? Can you unpack the word this?
Yes.
In that sentence.
Yes, yeah. I want to be doing work that is theater that is site-based, that is taking place outside of a theater right now. That's where I'm at. Not that if any of my plays get picked up and someone wants to do them, I would love to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just finding being outside of a theater to be especially creatively rich in this moment.
Mm-hmm.
Because we don't have to, I mean, it, like in a way, like I guess I'm becoming a gatekeeper. But I like to think that when I bring writers into the group, it's like, what do you want to do?
Mm-hmm.
Not what do you want to do and how can we make that happen? Not here's our thing. Can you write something for us?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And I just, that's where I find inspiration. Like when I walk into a theater now, there's many, many fantastic shows going on. I don't necessarily feel inspiration at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
But I do feel inspiration from space outside. And also I think, like, you know, I'm a person, and I don't know if you have this problem as a writer, but my brain just goes and goes and goes and goes.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I can't stop.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a problem because you need to, like, rein it in. And I find that working in spaces, you know, like we just did the furniture store or a boutique, or we've done with living room playmakers, church basements, bars, there is a natural just reining in that happens.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, okay, I have to make work for this three-dimensional real space, not something I made up in my head. And for me, that really helps. It helps inform the characters. It helps inform the story. It helps inform the dialogue. And I just couldn't be happier also creating work alongside other writers who I really admire and love right now.
Mm-hmm.
I find it very, you know, it's like putting pieces in juxtaposition to each other. I'm finding really exciting.
Yeah. I connect with that in a really big way, both in the collaborative side and also in the sort of site-specific experience.
Mm-hmm.
Like when I have my most favorite creative experiences have been collaborative,
mm-hmm.
where it's not simply here's the thing I wrote, now do it. It mm-hmm. is like here's this thing we are all creating together. It just feels, and I think part of that is because my lifelong yearning to be part of a team.
Like you mentioned before,
like you got into theater
and
not writing novels because you wanted to be part of a group. But then also shifting into the site specific stuff, when I've seen work that marries story and space, like the space and the story are married together and you feel like this story could only take place here.
Mm-hmm.
It is like, it's magical, and it mm-hmm. doesn't matter that there are 9 people in here mm-hmm. to experience it. And but I also feel the same way about like a show done in a theater.
Mm-hmm.
Like when it feels like this piece really like fits this space.
Yeah.
When it comes together like that, it's really kind of magical. It's just easier to do and a little bit more accessible when it is not in a theater space, because there's so many things that come along with being inside a theater.
Yes. And I think part of that too is the way that the audience experiences it.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we both know that sometimes people go to theater and they fall asleep.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's also something really exciting to me. And maybe it's like, you know, when I'm making work for an audience, like at first when I started writing plays, it was like, oh my God, they're so quiet.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was used to doing comedy.
Mm.
And so in site-based theater, you see the audience, they see you. And I think that, you know, it just changes their relationship with it, and it makes it so that they can, the hierarchy is different.
Mm-hmm.
Like, no, we just walked in here just like you did.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're also, you know, because in this last piece was so fast and furious, you know, obviously, you know, there's always things you would go back and change, but we cast the audience as shoppers, you know, obviously, you know, it's a store.
Mm-hmm.
And so the actors were able to play off of that sometimes, and not in a way that was like participatory, because I think that's kind of not what we do necessarily, but in a way that's like, oh, they hear us, so now I have to react to that. Or the audience is, you know, 3 feet away from you. What does that feel like? How does that inform the scene? You know, I'm not an actor, so I can't really speak to the acting, but also like in writing it, you have to think about that. And I really enjoy that, that it's not, you know, there's less control.
Mm-hmm.
There's less control over how the audience is experiencing it, because they can choose how close, how far away they want to be from in the moment.
Yeah.
In the middle of the scene, they could decide, oh, I want to take a couple steps closer and figure out what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So in creating Second Sight, you are in the role of founder and producer. Are you able to be fed or feed yourself as a writer, as a creator?
I am. Right now I'm doing a lot of producing.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also working on a short film, and I'm working on a feature length film.
Mm-hmm.
So those are my two big things. And we do have some projects coming up, which I can't yet talk about. But in the last week, like, we have a lot going on, which I'm very excited about. And it's, you know, something that maybe I felt like while I was just writing traditional plays, and, you know, I'm sure I will again. Like, I don't mean to say that I'm abandoning it. But, like, now that I've sort of chosen this path for now, I'm finding there's people who are kind of hungry for this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in particular, I'm going to be teaching a workshop for teenagers about site-based writing. And I think for young writers, I think that's really, like, helpful as a writer.
Yeah.
Because sometimes young writers, like, the space is just like, where are these people? and also, like, you don't need to have a fancy theater to do theater. You could do it on your porch. You could do it at the park down the street. You could do it in your garage. Like, it doesn't matter. And I think as we see, like, you know, unfortunately, some of these bigger houses disappearing, as we're in this moment of transition, like, we're all still here. All these writers, all these actors, we're all still here, and we still want to do the work. And I think I'm also, like, and maybe you feel this too, because you've been in it such a long time, like, sometimes I find that I'm surprised that I still want to do it, even though it's like the return maybe isn't what it used to be, or it changes. But there is something in me that's like, I need to do this kind of work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you find what you write or what you explore thematically changed or is changing because of the focus on location?
I do. I find that I'm writing work that is much more personal. Much more personal. Like, somehow having I feel like more vulnerability in my writing. And less, because I tend to write my traditional plays are not traditional. Like, they involve magical elements, right? And I love that, and I'll probably continue to write those kinds of things, but I'm finding more realism and more emotional depth maybe than I used to gravitate towards.
This conversation has, you know, I ask almost everybody some variation of this question, and I'm really curious how you feel today at this particular moment, given everything we just talked about, on the idea of what success is as a playwright, right? Like, how that is defined, has been defined, continues to be defined and evolving.
Yeah. I think that, oh, it's changed so much, you know? I mean, I think, like I said, when I went into this, I wanted a production on a big stage. I wanted, you know, an agent. I wanted commissions, and I wanted to work at a academic. I wanted to be a professor.
Mm-hmm.
Now that I've seen what that is, and I realize I got to a point where, and I think we all do it. It's like you see these sort of big opportunities, and you try to point towards it and think like, who's in the role who can get me in, right? And how can I've just, for the moment, might change tomorrow. I've let all that go. I'm like, you know what? Maybe that's not going to happen. No one's coming to save me. No one is coming to save me. And so I can be that person for myself. And so success right now means doing what I like with people I like and people who align with my values, which I think there's so many phenomenal people in Chicago theater, so many. And there are some people who don't align with my values and that I felt that I had to kind of like, you know, only show a certain side to myself and always be on guard. And, you know, I don't feel that in this moment. I feel like the people I'm working with are, I trust and I admire, and they know my values and I know theirs. And, you know, obviously we all have to grow and nobody's perfect, but yeah, that's.
You have a child who in the next couple of years will be experiencing a shift of some kind,
yeah.
right? Because
yeah.
they'll be finishing high school. How do you talk about these things that we've been talking about, these ideas of career or career with S in parentheses,
yes.
and success,
yes.
And how they should see this or define?
Yeah, we very much... I mean, my kid he's really good at school, which we're very lucky. I feel that sometimes young people, like what I hear from his peers, that they're being pushed into, you know, getting to the best college. And I just feel like he should do, the way we talk about it is you should do what is going to make you happy and you should do the best job at whatever you do. But if you need to take a break, if you need to go off on a tangent, if you start in one place and you go in another, it's okay because it's your life. I don't in the like dumpster fire of a world that we're in. I don't think pushing our kids and putting more pressure on them to achieve is doing anybody any good, because everything is shifting. And why not do something that makes you happy, even if it's not going to make $1 million, or going to shift again in 10 years.
Yeah.
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 And I'm sure it helps to see, parental influence happy and engaged with whatever it is they're doing, right? For a younger person, whether it's acknowledged or it's still experienced, I'm sure, and has an impact.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I really feel I've always been drawn to working with teenagers. I mean, that's what I went into in the beginning, but I really just, these kids in their teens and 20s, like what they must be going through, you know, alongside the rest of us, because they're trying to plan a future and the future is fraught and scary and like it's never been in history.
Yeah. It's a good note to end on, right? The future is fraught and scary. Good luck, everybody.
Have you read this book? I just read this book called Saving Time by Jenny O'Dell.
No.
Oh my gosh, you have to read it.
Is it a novel?
It's so good. No, it's a nonfiction book. And it's about time and the way that it's been used throughout history as a instrument of colonialism, and to the way nature experiences time, and you know, she talks about the environment, but she also talks about, well, if, you know, if these things are happening, then why not slow down and just enjoy what we're given? I don't know. I highly recommend.
An idea I can definitely embrace at the moment, this whole concept of slowing down, being where you are, doing what you're doing. Yeah. That's a much better note. Thank you, Jenny, for inviting me into your house, which is honestly my idealized home, right down to the record player and art on the walls. Check out Second Sight to learn more about the excellent projects they have coming up. Thank you to Rob, Ali, and Kalundra from American Theater Magazine, a program of Theater Communications Group. The music from this episode is from L of Cosmos. The theme for the subtext is by International Pen Pal. This episode was produced and edited by me. KJ Jarbo is the associate producer. Thank you for listening. The play filling me up this month is The Merchant of Venice, the Musical by Anna Tatelman. Or is it Tatelman? I should have asked. Ugh. Anna Tatelman. Anyway, I had the chance to meet Anna in person recently, and she's awesome. She told me about this musical she's working on and shared several tracks, and I think it is capital G great. So, theater producers out there, instead of doing the old Merchant of Venice, consider Anna's musical instead.